It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, Wisconsin hospitals have been spending less on discounted care for low-income people. We'll hear how that figures into the bigger financial picture for state hospitals and how things might change under a new health care bill in the U.S. Senate.
First, a federal appeals court yesterday affirmed an earlier ruling that Brendan Dassey's confession was coerced. Dassey was convicted of aiding his uncle, Stephen Avery, in the 2005 rape and murder of photographer Teresa Halbach in Manitowoc County. Their case became the subject of the Netflix series Making a Murderer and has captured national attention.
Much of the case built around Avery's and Dassey's conviction was based on that confession, but U.S. Magistrate Judge William Duffin, who overturned that conviction back in August, said that the confession was, quote, so clearly involuntary.
Larry White joins us now. He is a professor at Beloit College and an expert on the social psychology of police interrogations and false confessions. He's consulted on several criminal cases, including the Avery and Dassey case. Larry, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
What was your reaction to this decision by a federal appeals court yesterday?
I wasn't surprised because they affirmed the lower federal court's opinion. It'll be interesting to see what happens when they have the full Seventh Circuit Court consider the case.
We have a clip of Brendan Dassey's second interrogation, and in this clip we'll hear Special Agent Tom Fassbender speaking on the tape to Dassey, where he also refers to Investigator Mark Weigert.
I think Mark and I both feel that maybe there's some more that you could tell us. That you may have held back for whatever reasons. And I want to assure you that Mark and I both are in your corner. We're on your side.
And Larry, what do you hear in that clip?
Well, I hear the detectives who are interrogating Brendan Dassey trying to convince him that they are his support system, that they are his emotional allies. Back in 2007, I watched all of the recorded interrogations of Brendan Dassey, and this is something that the two detectives did repeatedly. They warned Dassey that he was in a precarious legal position, a dangerous legal position, and then they portrayed themselves as his friends. So at one point, I remember Fassbender says, "I want to be here for you. I know you're hurting. I wish I could come over there and give you a hug. I promise I'm not going to leave you high and dry. I'll stand behind you." And then also in these interrogations, the two detectives, they repeatedly told Brendan that he wasn't responsible for any criminal acts that he might tell them about, which, of course, is patently untrue. So they would tell him things like, it's not your fault. Remember that, Brendan. You've done nothing wrong. And so this led Brendan to think that he could tell them a fake story that, in fact, implicated himself and not be held responsible for it, which I guess explains why, when it was all said and done, Dassey had just admitted or said that he had raped and killed Teresa Halbach along with Stephen Avery, and then he asked the police if he can get back to school in time to turn in an assignment that afternoon.
Why would someone act in what seems to be clearly against their own self-interest and confess to something in this case as heinous as aiding and abetting in a rape and a murder, if they didn't do it?
Well, it's hard to believe that innocent persons would falsely confess, especially to these serious crimes like sexual assault and murder. We don't know the exact number of false confessions that happen each year, but all of the experts in this area agree that false confessions happen more often than most people realize. We know there have been documented cases of hundreds of innocent persons who have given false confessions, and what surprises almost everyone is that false confessions are more common in homicide cases than they are in other kinds of cases. You think it might just be the reverse of that. So why would somebody do that? You know, what is their mental state that leads them to admit to something that they didn't do? I think the typical false confessor is somebody who has been isolated in an interview room down at the police station, and they have been worn down by relentless questioning by the police, and they feel helpless to change the outcome. They've decided that it's in their best interest to say that they did it instead of continuing to insist that they didn't do it, and they give too much weight to the short-term benefits of confessing, and they give too little weight to the long-term consequences, all of which, of course, are negative.
Why would Brendan Dassey have confessed to a crime like that without an attorney or a guardian present?
Well, Brendan Dassey was 16 years old, there are many reports that indicate that he has limited intellectual abilities, and suspects, I mean, we know from studies that suspects who are young and who have low intelligence, they are more likely to confess. They're more suggestible. They're more easily tricked and psychologically manipulated by the police. And they're also less likely to understand their Miranda rights. And because they're less likely to understand those rights, they're less likely to invoke those rights, which means that they're less likely to have an attorney present with them when they're being questioned.
We're talking with Larry White right now, professor of psychology at Beloit College, and he joined us to talk about false confessions after an appeals court upheld an earlier ruling that Wisconsin's Brendan Dassey was coerced into confessing to a crime. And the judge who overturned Dassey's conviction mentioned, as you said, that he was a juvenile, that he had what he called intellectual deficits, no supportive adult. And you were asked to write a report on that confession by Avery's counsel. Did you see what you would have thought to be red flags back then?
Yes. It was clear that that Dassey was being manipulated by the detectives who were interrogating him. You have to remember that he was interrogated three or four times over a span of several days, and he was unable to provide any details about the crime, and so these detectives inadvertently fed him or leaked him details, and so that it appears that Dassey knows some things about what may or may not have happened, but it's only because the detectives had leak that information to him.
Is that kind of behavior, like we heard in that bit of the taping of the interrogation by detectives, saying things like, I'm on your corner, you're hurting, I want to give you a hug, is that common practice or was that unusual?
It's not unusual. In fact, when I reviewed the Dassey interrogations, I was struck by the degree to which the police officers were being very nice to Dassey, and that has happened in some other cases I've consulted on, but then there are other cases in which the questioning has been much more vigorous and confrontational. So there are different ways to skin the cat when it comes to extracting a confession from a suspect. The factors that, when we consider the factors that can lead to a false confession, the most important factor by far is the particular interrogation technique used by the police. And the most widely used technique in the United States is called the Reed technique. And in this approach to interrogation, detectives will isolate the suspect. They will confront the suspect by saying, we know you did it. Now we just want to know why you did it. Are you a monster, or is this something that just happened? So either one of those possibilities, of course, either one of those options is admitting guilt, but one of them sounds much less worse than the other one. And detectives using the Reed technique, they will offer inducements to the suspect. All of this is designed to make the suspect feel anxious, to make them feel helpless, to increase their suggestibility, and perhaps most importantly, to let the suspect come to believe that he will receive lenient treatment if he confesses.
So given all that, and that there are these well-used techniques during interrogations, as someone who is a social psychologist looking at police interrogations, do you think that anything should change procedurally and maybe legally in what's allowed in this kind of interrogation?
Yeah, the people who work in this area, social scientists and legal scholars alike, I think that they would point to three different reforms that have been proposed, each of which would minimize the risk of obtaining false confessions from innocent suspects. The first and most important thing, perhaps, is to have police departments record all of their interrogations, not just interrogations of juveniles, but to record all of their interrogations. I'm pleased to report that, to my knowledge, all police departments in the state of Wisconsin are now recording their interrogations. But there are many other police departments in other states who have not yet adopted that practice. A second reform that would be quite effective is to have police departments abandon the use of the Reed technique, to replace the Reed technique with a less risky technique that's called the information gathering approach. And this has been happening slowly but surely. Some police departments in big cities like Los Angeles are no longer using the Reed technique. Just this past March, there's one of the nation's largest law enforcement consulting firms announced that it was going to stop training detectives to use the Reed technique. Why? Because they said of the risk of false confessions. And then a third reform that would be useful is, every time there's a false confession, it's because the police have interrogated a person who is actually innocent. Well, the police only interrogate persons that they think are guilty. But some police departments have fairly low thresholds for what they consider guilty. So there's not very much evidence is required before they think this person is guilty, and then they start interrogating. And so those police departments are going to have a higher rate of false confessions because they're interrogating a larger number of suspects who are, in fact, innocent. So if police departments were to have an internal policy that says, we're only going to interrogate suspects where we have really good, solid evidence of guilt, then that would drastically reduce the number of false confessions.
And we'll leave it there. Larry, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate that.
You're welcome.
We were talking there to Larry White, professor of psychology at Beloit College, and he was with us today to talk about false confessions after an appeals court upheld an earlier ruling that Wisconsin's Brendan Dassey was coerced into confessing to a crime. And you can weigh in. Tell us what you think. If you watched the Netflix series Making a Murderer, what is your take on this and the movement through the courts, particularly as we see this case of Brendan Dassey change over time? Let us know what you think. Share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
The Wisconsin Department of Justice told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that it's evaluating the court's decision. By the way, the department said it hopes the, quote, erroneous decision will be reversed, end quote, and that it continues sending condolences to the family of the victim, Teresa Halbach. Right now, Wisconsin's hospitals have adapted to a new dynamic since the passage of the Affordable Care Act. One of the biggest changes has been a drop in charity care or discounted medical care for low-income people. With more people insured, the amount state hospitals spent on charity care fell each year since 2013.
But changes in Medicare offset some of those savings, and the effort in Congress to change health care coverage could shake things up for hospitals in the state.
David Wahlberg joins us now. He's the health and medicine reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Well, what kind of services, first of all, do hospitals provide under charity care?
Yeah, so charity care is basically free care or reduced cost care that hospitals provide to people who qualify for it, basically through having a low income and a need for it.
And this can be a pretty substantial part of a hospital's budget, right?
It can vary, but in recent years it's been about 1% of a hospital's budget. In previous years it's been more like 2 or 3 or 4%.
Right. What has the impact of the Affordable Care Act been so far on people needing this kind of charity care from hospitals?
Yeah, so, I did a story recently that showed that the amount of charity care that hospitals in Wisconsin and in Madison and essentially nationwide have provided has dropped since the Affordable Care Act really kicked in 2014. And that's basically because a lot more people have insurance, and so they don't need charity care as much.
Now, that's just part of the picture. Obviously, all the healthcare stuff we're seeing is complicated. You covered a couple other angles in that piece to see how it all balanced out. You also looked at bad debt for hospitals. Now, I imagine that's where someone comes in, they don't have coverage to pay for it, and ultimately they don't or can't pay their hospital bills. Is that right?
Right. Bad debt is when basically the hospital determines that the people could pay, but they don't end up paying.
And how much has that changed over the course of the Affordable Care Act?
That has also dropped by about the same amount. Bad debt has gone down in Wisconsin by 34% from 2013 to 2015, where charity care went down by about 46% during that same time.
So both these things seem like pieces of good news for hospital budgets. Less bad debt, that's good. Having to give out less charity care, so they're getting paid for more of the services they provide. But you write in your piece there's another factor balancing that out, and that's how hospitals are getting paid through Medicare.
Right. So part of the trade-off that hospitals agreed to with the Affordable Care Act was to accept some Medicare cuts over several years, and the government was basically using that money to help subsidize the coverage that people are getting on the healthcare exchanges, and I believe it also helps pay for some of the Medicaid payments that expanded coverage through the Affordable Care Act. So the big question now with these new bills in Congress that would overturn much of the Affordable Care Act is whether those Medicare cuts would remain. And so far, it looks like in both the Senate bill and the House bill, those cuts would remain. So that causes some concern from hospitals, because they would basically have to keep the sort of quote-unquote bad part of the Affordable Care Act, at least from their perspective, these Medicare cuts, but they would lose the good part of some of the coverage expansion.
Has it been a wash so far when you stack up the decline in bad debt and charity on one side as a pro for hospitals, and then the loss of revenue because of lower Medicare reimbursement on the other side?
It probably varies from hospital to hospital, and I'm not sure exactly what they'd say, but I think it's roughly been a wash. Some hospitals say that they've saved enough through the reduction in charity care and bad debts to be able to spend some of that money on other programs, like UW Hospital, for example, told me that they had enough savings from that to spend more on some prevention programs, especially people with really complex medical needs, to sort of help them avoid coming to the hospital, for example.
So in theory, that's cutting future costs.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Talking to David Wahlberg from the Wisconsin State Journal, looking at hospitals and how they've been faring under the Affordable Care Act when it comes to giving charitable care, the bad debt that they carry, and Medicare reimbursements, and how that could change with the passage, possibly, of a new health care act by Congress. David, how, big picture, how are hospitals doing in Wisconsin compared to peers around the country?
So in terms of operating margins, which is sort of the main way to look at the financial status of hospitals, our operating margins are a little bit better than the national average. So nationally, it's been about 6.2% in recent years. Statewide, it's been about 9.7%. And then I looked at the hospitals in Madison. They've been a little bit less than the state average, 7.4% at UW, 8.1% at St. Mary's, and 4.8% at Meritor. And to give a little context to that, traditionally experts have said that nonprofit hospitals, which of course get tax breaks, that they need 3 to 5% operating margin to sort of reinvest in their services and keep afloat. But now hospitals are saying, well, they're part of larger health systems that lose money in other ways, so the hospital itself actually needs a larger operating margin.
And then I know it can be hard to generalize around a state like Wisconsin. We've heard issues at rural hospitals in being able to provide all the services they need, in some cases, to stay open. Do we have a sense of how rural hospitals in particular are doing?
I haven't looked at rural hospitals specifically in recent years with their operating margins, but I know in the past some have had lower operating margins and others have had higher. So they're paid by a slightly different method than other hospitals. So it gets a little complicated, but I guess I would just say that the picture is probably kind of mixed right now.
And then looking ahead, as we're talking, of course, senators are considering their own health care plan, the Republican health care plan there. You mentioned hospitals worried that they might lose the good side, the expanded coverage, the cut in bad debt, while keeping the bad side from their perspective of the Affordable Care Act, the lower Medicare reimbursements. How worried are they? Is this seen as something that it would be a small hit, or could this be a pretty big dent in hospitals' operating budgets?
Well, and there's actually two things going on the sort of bad side. So there's the Medicare cuts that we talked about that they have absorbed through the Affordable Care Act that might remain. And then also in Wisconsin, there's sort of a penalty, if you will, for Medicaid, which is the state federal program for largely for the poor. So because Wisconsin partially expanded Medicaid but didn't do it fully under the Affordable Care Act, we stand to lose quite a bit more money under these congressional bills, the Senate and the House bill, than states that fully expanded Medicaid. So according to the Wisconsin Hospital Association, we would lose about $37 billion over about 10 years compared to expansion states. So hospitals are concerned about that and the Medicare cuts.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's good to be here.
That was David Wahlberg, health and medicine reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He was with us to talk about changing financial pictures at Wisconsin hospitals under the Affordable Care Act. Right now, it's time for Food Friday, and if you love fresh produce, there's no better time than now to talk about food. Farmers markets around the state are in full swing, and with so many fruits and veggies now in season, there's a just about endless supply of food to buy and take home with you.
But you can only buy so many things from the market, so where should you start? And once you actually get the food home, there's the question of what to do with it. You can call it maybe farmer's market paralysis.
So this week we asked our own Lori Skelton for a little bit of help to maximize our trips to the market this summer. Lori is one of WPR's in-house foodies. She's a Food Friday regular. Lori, welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, what's the most exciting thing about the farmers markets right now?
The fact that you've got tried and true things that you know to expect, that you can plan for, but also more and more you are finding surprises. So it's a good idea to go with a shopping list, but also go with an open mind. And if you see something you've never tried before, this is a great time to experiment.
So, Lori, let's say you do that. You go and you buy stuff that looks pretty. Maybe it smells good and you've never cooked with it before, maybe. How do you start? How do you figure out where to go from there?
Well, before you even get it home, may I offer a suggestion? Go to the farmer's market early so you have an opportunity to talk to the vendor. I know in the Madison market, crowds can get a little bit thick even by 9 o'clock in the morning. So I realize this is not what you want to hear first thing on a Saturday morning, but go early. Ideally, it's nice if you can make a round of the market, see who's got what, talk to the vendor, see how they're using it, then go around again and make your selection. So start with a little bit of a plan and start with the idea that if you are encountering something that's new to you, hey, there's a reason that farmer grew it. Somebody either asked him or her for it, or it's something they already enjoy working with. Or, again, if you're in Madison, one good thing to do if you're at the market early is you follow Tory Miller from L'Etoile and Gray's around. He's there with all of his assistants in the kitchen. They've got big wagons. Find out what Tory is buying and go ahead and ask him.
And then we're at home. We've got the produce on the counter or in the fridge. Okay. Farmers market or CSA or from the store. And what do we do with it? And you've got an idea, a suggestion this week. Don't think so much in terms of recipes. Think in terms of structures or templates, kind of. Why is that?
Because there you've got the room to experiment, but if you're keeping certain ratios in mind, you never need to worry that you're going to go completely off the rails. One of the things that we've got on the website right now are the basic ideas for cold noodle salads, which are a great idea. You have an opportunity to use a lot of different kinds of produce. You don't have to worry about mayonnaise going bad in this particular salad. But if you start with, say, too much noodle, you're not going to get a great feel for the vegetables that you're putting in. Or if you've got too much vegetable and not enough of a balance with something crunchy or something spicy or an assertive dressing, it's going to go rather bland on you very, very quickly. One thing to remember about any kind of cold salad, especially in the summer, this needs to have a real punch, especially in how you dress it. You'll want to perhaps give a little bit of extra salt to your vegetables as you're preparing them. You want to be thinking, again, I'm backing away from mayonnaise for most of my salads this summer. I'm thinking thinned out peanut butter or another nut butter. I'm thinking tahini. I'm thinking miso. I'm thinking soy sauce and fish sauce and even in some cases anchovy, if I know that the people I'm serving it to aren't going to have a complete meltdown.
So, Laura, you gave us some basic ideas there. Can you walk us through that template for the cold noodle salad, but ingredient by ingredient, so we kind of know what components we're going to be playing with?
Okay. Bon Appetit magazine's template starts off for a serving for four people. You're going to start with 8 ounces of dried noodles, whether that's soba or udon or ramen or rice noodles. Vermicelli, you can even go straight spaghetti if you want. 8 ounces of dry pasta. But whatever your noodle, and here's something that may help. Go ahead and make your noodles ahead of time. You'll want to get them a little past al dente. You want them nice and chewy. Strain them, rinse them thoroughly in cold water, then blot them dry with paper towels and toss on just a little bit of neutral oil, like canola, like grapeseed oil. Then you can store them in your refrigerator and maybe use them the next day and to put together a really fresh cold noodle salad. Then you're going to want some protein. Not too much. Maybe no more than, say, 2 cups of shredded chicken or 1/2 pound or so of sliced pre-made beef or shrimp. If you're someone who tends to overcook your omelets, if your omelets don't come out light and fluffy, this is where a cold noodle salad can be a real lifesaver. Firm pieces of egg, whether it's a firm omelet or hard-boiled egg, are also another good protein source for a cold noodle salad. From there, you're going to want about 4 cups of raw vegetables. Definitely go for things that have crunch. Then on top, think about things like toasted nuts or toasted seeds. If you're going very, very Asian, you may even want to crumble a little bit of seaweed on top of your salad. End up with something a little bit spicy, maybe a chopped jalapeno or a little bit of Szechuan peppercorn, and then that tangy, assertive dressing, and you're good to go.
Talking to Lori Skelton on this edition of Food Friday. She's helping us make the most of seasonal produce, maybe that stuff you're finding at your local farmer's market. Lori, when it comes to salad making, salad's one of those foods that I find always tastes better when somebody else made it. But maybe what are some of the pitfalls that I may have or that anyone might have that make their salads less good? I've definitely done the over-noodling on a noodle salad, and it's like bland and boring. Any other things to watch out for?
Go easy on the dressing when you're dressing it. Don't log down your salad. You can always add more at the table. In some cases, you may want to hold back one element of the dressing. Say you want to include toasted sesame seed oil with your dressing. Maybe you want to hold that back and drizzle that just on the top right when you're serving it. So handle the dressings with a light hand and keep everything else in proportion. That's why you don't want to tie yourself down with a recipe, but you also don't want to just think, I can throw everything in the bowl and it will take care of itself.
Lori, let's talk about some of those baby baby root veggies, things with greens that you might be inclined to chop off and get rid of. What should we do with those kinds of things?
This is so lovely. I am seeing more and more farmers show up with baby vegetables in the market. Yes, baby beets are showing up right now. Of course, if you've got your own gardens, you know that you have to be thinning all of your root vegetables to make certain they grow properly. So you may have your own supply of baby carrots, baby turnips, baby rutabaga, kohlrabi is out there right now. And one thing that one vendor at the Madison Market started showing up with years ago that I'm now seeing from more and more farmers, at the time they called them baby white turnips. It's actually a separate variety of turnip called Tokyo turnip. They are meant to be eaten small and ideally, I think, raw. They're about the size of a radish. They're bright, bright white. They will be sold with the greens on. And they've got a pleasant little bitter taste when they're chopped up again in a salad. If you want to sauté or steam them or even roast them, that's going to make them sweeter. But whatever you do, try and make the greens that are sold with your veggie a part of the dish if necessary. Here, if you're making a salad, chop up your turnips, toss them with your salad. Wait on the greens, though, again, until right before you serve it. Then throw the greens in. You don't need to worry about logging it down with too much dressing. The greens will still be bright and snappy, but the vegetables will have a chance to absorb the dressing and get even more interesting.
Sometimes when I use the greens on root vegetables, it seems like they get wilty really fast. Do I have to make sure I just turn it around really quickly?
You might try, if you're really worried, say you're using your greens maybe a day or two after you bought them, they're starting to already look a little limp, go ahead and shock them in an ice water bath. Or if you really want to get fancy, blanch them for 30 seconds in boiling water, then shock them in an ice water bath. That will usually revive just about any green.
We're talking with Food Friday regular Lori Skelton right now about cooking from the summer farmers market. And she's sharing tips on what to look for at the market or maybe your local grocery store where you're starting to see more of these seasonal veggies and how to turn all of that into delicious meals.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite ingredient this time of year that you find maybe at the farmers market? What do you like to do with it? If you've got something that you bought on a whim, maybe you're not sure what to do with it, call. Maybe Lori can give some suggestions. And if you're on the other side of the market stand, what are you selling now that is awesome? What do you think people should be paying more attention to? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post, find some recipes and other advice on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in a little bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're talking with Food Friday regular Lori Skelton about cooking from the summer farmers market, or if not directly from the market, with all of those fresh veggies that are popping up at grocery stores and stands around the state. Lori's here to help us navigate the familiar and the unfamiliar at the market and how to make some great meals out of all that.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you buying at the farmers market? What have you found? What have you done with it? Are you a big farmers market fan? Do you like cooking with Wisconsin's seasonal produce this time of year? Do you have a question about a mystery product you saw at a stand, got in your CSA, you name it, and what the heck to do with it? And if you are a farmer, a gardener, maybe a vendor at a farmers market, what are you excited about right now? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page and find us some recipes over there.
And Laura, you wanted to focus on something today that you're calling assertive greens.
Yep.
I'm kind of partial to the super bland ones like baby butter lettuce, but tell me why I should get excited about assertive greens.
Well, part of this has to do with I spent my vacation in Seattle, and I went to a couple of really amazing Chinese restaurants while we were out there. And I was reminded of how good Chinese broccoli is drizzled with just a little bit of oyster sauce. in a Chinese restaurant as a side dish. And right now, you've got a great pick of mustard and collard greens, broccoli leaves rather than just the broccoli, your baby bok choys, your chicory, your Belgian endive, arugula. Right now, you can play around with those flavors because they make a lovely, simple accompaniment for some of our easiest summer cooking. If you're one of these people like me who picks up a rotisserie chicken about once a week, assertive greens, again, with a really assertive dressing, like oyster sauce, very simply steamed or sautéed is a fantastic accompaniment for a simple roast chicken or a simple piece of fish on the grill. You're eating light, but because you've got a good green on your plate, you're also eating incredibly healthy. One thing that has shown up at one particular vendor, Jones Valley Farm in the Madison Market, these folks are really great about bringing Italian varietals to the market, and last weekend they showed up with something called puntarelle, which is you have to make the greens separately, and you do have to spend a little bit of time fiddling around with the stems of this Italian green, but this is something that has near cult status in Rome. Huh. And once you get around the fiddly preparation, cut the leaves off, cut the pieces into manageable chunks, stick those in ice water for a couple of hours until they curl up. They sort of look like when you smash a dandelion, those little curly cues. Mm-hmm. All you need to do is dress it with a little bit of garlic, red wine vinegar, a little bit of olive oil, and a little bit of mashed anchovy, and you've got this amazing, very strong but not overpowering accompaniment to a really gentle summer meal. You can go easy on everything else and let the greens take over. And this was one where I found out those greens were so assertive you didn't notice how fishy the anchovies were.
Let's bring on our callers now. Eddie is with us in Viroqua. Eddie, hi.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for the great show. We have an awesome co-op here in Viroqua, as well as a farmer's market twice a week, and one of the things I've been tasting is garlic scapes.
Oh, yes. I've just cut the last of them out of my garden. Aren't they so good?
Oh, they're so beautiful. The lady at the co-op, Christy, made some amazing pesto out of them, and a couple nights ago we fried some pork chops in the scapes, and when they get to that crispy sort of almost burned place where they're crunchy. Oh, so good.
Absolutely. Garlic scape pesto is a little bit more freezer stable even than your standard basil pesto, so that's a great way, if you can make some and then freeze it, to hang on to some of summer for next winter. Good on
you. Even adding a little garlic mustard to it, which is a bane of our existence out here.
You eat your enemies. I highly recommend throwing garlic mustard in. Good for you.
Eddie, thanks for the call. And I'm never sure how much of the scape I can use. Which bits should I cook with and which is just...
If somebody has handed you a scape, you eat the whole thing.
None of it escapes.
None of it escapes. Absolutely. Get the whole thing on your plate. It's one of the things that you can use. One of the other recipes that I asked you to put up on the Central Time website today was a greens pasta salad from a recent edition of Food and Wine. And this is a place where garlic scapes could be really, really useful. This is a green salad that has pasta in it and has a kind of a mayonnaise dressing, but it's not the gloppy, heavy mm-hmm. mayonnaise dressing we're used to. It's actually more greens than pasta. The basic recipe is asparagus, peas, pasta, and a half pound of arugula. But this is some place where you could gently steam those garlic scapes, throw that in addition to or instead of some of the other greens. One of the reasons I asked you to include this recipe is this is a recipe, again, you don't have to follow to the letter. You can get really, really creative depending on what you find at the market.
Nice. And thanks a lot, Eddie. You made those sound really tasty.
Oh, they are so good.
All right, let's go next to Chloe in Green Bay. Chloe, hi.
Hi. So I'm a college student just cooking for one. I'm just wondering, what are your suggestions for preserving produce long-term? I already like freeze rhubarb and things, but is there anything else I can do?
Rhubarb was going to be the first thing I said. That is a problem with greens in of themselves. It's hard for the home cook to get those so that they're stable in the freezer. What I would suggest is go ahead and make casseroles or gratins, even if you don't cook them all the way, look for recipes that are good to freeze, and then give yourself an afternoon and cook for this winter. Go ahead and make things that you'll need to do in 6 months' time is pull it out of the freezer and pop it in the microwave. Rather than getting ingredients for the long term, try playing around with what can I make to freeze now. Do you like playing around with phyllo dough?
I'm sorry?
Do you like playing around with phyllo dough? Have you ever made like a puff pastry roll?
I never have. No.
Well, believe it or not, that was one of the first things I did when I started cooking for myself. And you go out, you get a package of puff pastry, and then you spend the afternoon making savory, like long rolls of pastry, big long pastry logs, which you then wrap up well in a couple of layers of aluminum foil, stick those in the freezer, and those will keep for months. And it's a lovely feeling when you can come home, you've had a rough day, you really don't want to cook, and then you, oh, that's right, I've got a rice and broccoli phyllo puff waiting for me in the freezer. So
all
try
right.
that.
Good luck, Chloe. We'll go next to Mary Beth on the line in Waukesha. Mary Beth, hi.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I am new to shopping at farmers markets. I'm excited about it, but I have a great recipe I want to try with zucchini. I'm just wondering if it's too early to find those.
I haven't seen any yet. That doesn't mean they won't start showing up. It's been an interesting year with the temperatures kind of going back and forth. We had a little bit cooler start than I was anticipating. I wouldn't be surprised if zucchini were not to start showing up this weekend, but you're right. That is something you really, again, if you're planning for it, you're probably going to be planning for it later in the summer, but if you, it certainly could happen.
And my zucchini is just starting to flower in the backyard now. I start later than the farmers do, I assume, but
yeah.
It's going to be ways off for me.
Mary Beth, you piqued my curiosity. Just briefly, what is your fancy recipe, your tasty recipe?
Soft tortilla shells out of zucchini, gluten-free. A friend gave it to me who's doing the Whole30 diet. I'm not doing it, but I'm trying to eat healthier, and it's made with arrowroot flour and coconut flour.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and I've heard of zucchini pizza crust, too, so this is something that's out there.
Wow.
Yeah, Lori's taking notes. This could be our next food Friday.
So I may have to just get them at the grocery store, but...
All right, Mary Beth,
good
that
luck.
Sounds yummy. Thank
Report
you for
back.
Trying.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, thanks for that call. And yeah, some homework there we can do on zucchini tortillas and zucchini pizza crust.
Okay.
We have time, I think, for one more caller. Dan in Rockford, Illinois. Dan, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to ask about?
I was wondering, I have found over the years that I really enjoy the crunch and the therapeutic benefits of raw garlic. And it even works for my heartburn if I get it. But I don't know how to buy it in the farmer's market fresh and then store it a significant amount of time without it starting to grow on me or go bad. And I was wondering if I could peel it, the individual cloves, and put it covered in olive oil, if that would work for me, if that would store it better in the fridge.
Okay. You don't want to just stick it in olive oil. You want to do what's called confit. You want to gently simmer those garlic cloves in olive oil on the stove for at least 20 minutes. Double check. You can Google garlic confit, which is spelled C-O-N-F-I-T. Google garlic confit. Double check the time. But once you have gotten those garlic cloves cooked a little bit, you then store them in the oil you cooked them in. This is a French technique that they use for preserving a lot of things. And again, it's one of those lovely things. You've got garlic confit in the refrigerator. You've got great meals ahead.
Nice. Thanks for the call. And Lori, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
That's Lori Skelton, one of our in-house foodies, a Food Friday regular. We've got links to the recipes Lori mentioned, including the one for greens pasta salad. You can find that over on the Central Time Facebook page. And while you're there, send us a picture of the produce you're cooking with this weekend.
Cheese is is the official dairy product of Wisconsin as of this month. And now Governor Walker and state and UW officials are hitting the road to promote cheese made right here in the state.
That all happens Monday, which by some coincidence is apparently Wisconsin Cheese Day.
That's right. And the governor will visit Klondike Cheese in Monroe, according to the Associated Press. Other officials will be at Masters Gallery Foods in Plymouth, Great Lakes Cheese in La Crosse, Westby Cooperative Creamery, Beery Cheese in Plover, and Renard's Cheese in Algoma.
What is your favorite Wisconsin cheese? Tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us a message via the Central Time Facebook page. You've got some definite favorites.
I do. What's the word for a food? The cheese version of foodie? A cheesy?
A cheesy. I wouldn't roll with that. No.
All right. Well, anyway, I'm a cheese lover. Let's say that. And goat cheese is something my whole family likes, but it cannot be too goaty. It cannot be. It cannot be too much of the essence of goat, but it can be delicious.
And the story of my cheese life is we'll get something at the store, really like it, finish it off, forget what it was, forget what brand it was, and just have to hunt for something new the next time. So I should get a cheese notebook. The real cheesies have their own cheese book.
I could make one. No, I don't have one. But I could start one easily and give you some notes.
Yeah, one of those power journals of cheese. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.